This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jack Lew went to Detroit and all we got was this lousy interview. Actually, it's a pretty good interview. The Secretary of the Treasury on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kai Rizdahl in the studios at WAMU today. Great to have you with us on a Friday, everybody. It's the 25th of April today. Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew has spent the latter part of this week in Detroit, Michigan, without too much argument, America's most troubled big city. The mayor and the city manager there are working on a plan to get Detroit out of bankruptcy, and the White House is trying to show its support with some federal dollars for, among other things, blight removal. Mr. Secretary, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you today, Kai.
Detroit's been in trouble for a while, sir. Can't help but wonder why you picked now to pay a visit.
Well, look, Detroit's had challenges over the last decades, but in the last several years in particular, it's been a very hard time. Yesterday afternoon, I visited the Mary Grove neighborhood in Detroit. It's a neighborhood that was solid middle-class housing, but now, like many neighborhoods in Detroit, vacant properties are causing a blight, and if they're not torn down, you can see how it spreads to the neighborhood. I was with the mayor yesterday as the first houses were torn down. I was impressed with the strategy and the execution, and it was a creative use of a federal program to make a difference, and I think it will make a difference.
On the bigger topic of the housing market and real estate in this country, it has been recovering, as you know, from the depths of the recession, but it does seem to have stalled a little bit. It's getting a little flat. I wonder how worried you are about the future of the larger economy if housing gets stuck. I mean, it's such a huge part of what we do.
Look, I think if you look at where we are in the recovery, we've seen month after month steady progress. We're seeing a recovery that's taking hold. Our problem is we need more new construction and we need more new household formation. The progress we've made is important, but until every American who can work is working, until everyone who could qualify for a mortgage is able to get a mortgage, we still have more work to do.
Yeah, well, about that, Mr. Secretary, I grant you that the economy is recovering and jobs are being created and GDP is growing. We talk about that on this show all the time. Why then, when we talk to regular people out there and when our reporters go out and talk to regular people, why does it feel so soft? Why isn't it more tangible?
You know, Kai, the recession of 08-09 left deep scars. We are seeing a healing, but it's a long process. And families don't forget quickly if they lost their home and they lost their job. I think that there is growing confidence. I think there is a lot of money on the sidelines that's prepared to come back as the confidence deepens. And
you sound like my stockbroker friends. There's money on the sidelines.
Well, you know, when you're seeing companies retaining earnings and holding back on making investments, it means they have capital to invest. The question is, what does it take to get them to make the investment?
But Mr. Secretary, with all respect, we've been waiting for companies in this economy to start hiring and start doing things with the money they have for literally years now.
Well, we've seen progress. I think, you know, while I think there's still much more to be done, I think if you compare the economy today to the economy just a few years ago, it's a world better. You know, we're seeing
it is, and that's not what I'm doing though, sir. Right? I'm comparing what companies can do and what they are doing.
No, but even companies are making investments. We're seeing in the manufacturing area investments, and there are things we can do to help small companies for them to get access to capital that they need. I think it's mostly larger businesses that have the retained earnings, and I'm actually hearing quite a bit of optimism when I talk to CEOs. That is the kind of thing you need before you see the big investments.
Couple of things I want to touch on with you, Mr. Secretary, before you have to run. The first is international affairs. As the guy whose name goes on a lot of the economic sanctions documents against the Russians for their activities in Russia and Crimea and Ukraine, I wonder when you expect sanctions might start to have an effect, if at all, on President Putin's actions. Because so far, sir, as you know, it hasn't done much.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to look at the sanctions. If sanctions have the effect of creating conditions and then leaders make decisions whether they change their policies. I think if you look at the conditions since we started imposing sanctions, they're having an impact.
You are just back from continuing with your international duties. You're just back from the spring meetings with the World Bank and the IMF. Lots of talk about China and developing economies. What do you expect out of the Chinese economy as it slows, as growth there sort of is not what it once was?
Well, look, China is facing a number of economic challenges. Obviously, they're facing some slowing down of their economy. You know, when I meet with my counterparts in China, I'm struck at how much they understand intellectually what they need to do and how hard it is. And I've made clear that on issues like exchange rate, it is just not sustainable or acceptable to be on a path where the exchange rate continues to fall and creates unfair advantage. The world can't look to the United States to provide all the growth that is needed for a healthy world economy. And China is a big part of the world economy as the second largest economy in the world.
You know, it seems to me, sir, that you guys do, you and the president and Secretary Kerry, you do a lot of saying that things are unacceptable, that things have to change. And if they don't, well, the United States is going to be really upset. But you look at the Russians and sanctions aren't doing anything there. You look at the Chinese and they're doing what they want with their exchange rates. What then are you left to do?
Well, look, I don't accept your characterizations. I don't think the sanctions are being taken lightly in Russia. I think it's very – whether or not a government changes its policies is separate from the question of whether or not sanctions are doing what sanctions can do. You know, we have sanctioned some of the most significant people in Russia close to the president. We have sanctioned a bank that's the bank that they all bank at. We see many signs that it is having an effect. And, you know, frankly, the goal is to hurt the Russian economy while doing the least damage necessary to the U.S. and the global economy. And I think, you know, we've made clear we're prepared to take tougher actions and that we're prepared to absorb, you know, the consequences of that if we need to. But this has to be done in a careful way and it has to be done in an effective way. And that's what we're doing.
Do you think the consequences of American and Western sanctions on the Russians might be damage to the American economy?
Look, there's no question but that you know, when you stop doing business with a country as large as Russia, that there are effects outside of the boundaries of the country. So there are parties, you know, there are American companies that are already feeling some of the pinch. And there are European businesses that are feeling some of the pinch. The real burden is being felt in Russia. Look, you look at what happened with the rating agencies in Russia just over the past day. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing to be taken lightly to be one notch away from junk, you know, rating. You look at the exchange rate of the ruble, the value of the Russian stock market. Russia's economy is not doing well, and they acknowledge it's doing worse because of sanctions. So sanctions are doing what sanctions can do, and we will ratchet them up if we need to in response to Russia's behavior. But ultimately, President Putin needs to reevaluate his policies, and he needs to take a step back.
Last thing, sir, and I'll let you go. It's the same question I asked your predecessor when we had him on a couple of years ago. He, like you, had a famously illegible signature. Yours has come to be called the loop-de-loo. You had to change it to get it on the money so it was legible. How long did you have to practice that new signature?
I've been working on my handwriting for over 50 years.
You and me both. You and me both. Jack Lew, he's the Secretary of the Treasury. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, guy.
Wall Street today? Yeah, you don't want to go there, I think. We'll have the details, though, when we do the numbers. It takes a lot to knock our weekly wrap out of the top spot on the Friday show. Something like, yeah, I don't know, the Secretary of the Treasury. Nevertheless, here we are, Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, I want to pick up on a couple of things the Secretary said, the first of which was right at the tail end there, that bit about American companies perhaps paying a little bit of price for the sanctions that are going to be imposed on the Russians, that have been imposed on the Russians. Do you think that's actually going to be a factor for American companies?
Well, if you look at the economy overall, Russia accounts for a very small portion of U.S. trade. The same is not as true for Russia. A higher share of Russia's imports and exports go to the U.S. than vice versa, just because of the size of our trade versus theirs. But that doesn't mean that there aren't specific companies that will suffer. I mean, Visa has already said that that the sanctions are likely having an effect on its performance. The other likely culprits are like Boeing or Exxon, Morgan Stanley. There are a number of major U.S. companies that have complained about both sanctions that already exist and ones that appear to currently be on the table because they could hurt their business as well.
Right. Sudeep, the idea that the ratings agencies have now said to the Russians, look out, man, you're getting real close to junk bond status. A point clearly in the Secretary's favor, right?
Yes, and there are a lot of warnings coming at Russia, but we've seen warnings for weeks and months, and they haven't really made that much of a difference. The sanctions so far have barely scratched the surface. There are a lot of things that could be placed on the Russian economy to force the hand of some of the leaders there, at least to get them thinking a lot harder about what's being done. And for instance, the energy sector, there are a lot of things, and those have ramifications for the rest of the economy there in Europe, in the United States. And so that's what you have to look at here. The only way this conflict seems likely to stop is by turning up the heat economically and exerting a little bit more pain and perhaps a lot more pain on the Russian economy. And eventually you will turn it up enough that the Russians will have the Russian leadership will have no choice. But the question here is how much pain do you end up with on regular Russians and regular Ukrainians and regular Europeans and ultimately regular Americans in all of this?
Well, Catherine, let's talk about regular Americans. And the other thing that the Secretary mentioned that I wanted to talk about, that idea of it feeling still rough out there for a lot of people in this economy. He said things are bouncing back. People don't forget losing their homes, but confidence is going to come back eventually. And in fact, there was a consumer confidence number out today that shows consumers are feeling better almost since they have since the beginning of the Great Recession. How do you account for the confidence numbers coming up and yet still unemployment being where it is and joblessness being where it is?
Well, if you break down those confidence numbers, they come from the University of Michigan. They have a survey that comes out every month. So if you can sort of look at the different components of the survey and say, okay, where are people feeling a little bit better and where are they still kind of pessimistic? The places where people seem to be a little bit more optimistic was were places like job prospects. You know, people say that they've experienced some income gains. You know, they perceive inflation to be low. They basically think that their current financial status is doing a little bit better than it had been. Where they're a little bit more pessimistic, or at least you haven't seen the same growth in optimism, I'll put it that way, is economic conditions in the future. That's where Americans are still a little bit more cautious.
So, Sudeep, what do you suppose, just to bring it back to Washington, since that's where the three of us are sitting today, what do you suppose Congress, when it eventually comes back, is going to make of this? All right, and we're done. Thank you very much. No,
Congress is focused on an election, and there are going to be people who are trying to highlight what's bad about the economy, and there's plenty that's bad. There is a fair amount that's good. At least we're improving. The stock market, despite the recent wiggles, is still at a record high. It's just not filtering through across the spectrum as quickly as it needs to for us to feel like this is a real recovery.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, who says there aren't good manufacturing jobs anymore, huh?
I can make more than double using my mind instead of breaking my body.
High tech in upstate New York coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. After a relatively solid week, the bottom pretty much fell out on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials off 140 points, 0.8%, closed at 16,361, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ got clobbered. It shed 72 points, 1.75%, 4,075, 4,075 there. The S&P 500 down 15 points, also 0.8%, ended things at 1,863. For the week that was, the Dow off 0.3%. The NASDAQ removed 0.5%. The S&P 500 lopped off 0.1%. Weakness in the housing market, just like Secretary Liu just mentioned, was a big drag all around. We've got a new report that new mortgages are at their lowest point in 14 years. Homebuilders Lennar and KB Homes both slipped more than 2%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for March. Congress returns from recess. Here's something that goes well with coffee or cocktails. Great poetry reading day. And talk show host Jay Leno turns 64. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce behemoth, is working on an initial stock offering. That much we have told you before. The new part is the sheer size. We are talking historically big, a valuation of maybe $200 billion with a B dollars, and an IPO that could raise $20 billion in cash for the company, which got that big how? Marketplace's Sabri Menashor reports.
China, for starters, and secondly, it's huge. Alibaba is a site for buying and selling stuff online, so usually people describe it as a combination of Amazon and eBay. But really, that's not the half of it.
Yes, they're a combination of Amazon and eBay, but also PayPal, Yahoo, and let's throw in a Chase or a Citibank on the side as well.
Ezra Palmer is with eMarketer. Palmer says Alibaba is the largest mobile payment provider in China and the world. It's also a leader in internet ad technology in China. In fact,
one of the main ways that it's monetizing the activity on its platform is with advertising.
Evan Wilson is a senior research analyst with Pacific Crest Securities.
Alibaba will also allow sellers to advertise, and that advertising comes at a high profit margin.
And Alibaba is very profitable. Brian Weiser is with Pivotal Research.
Last year, Alibaba generated almost $8 billion of actual revenue with about a 43% profit margin, like real cash money.
You know who else has profit margins like that? Nobody, except maybe Facebook, says Weiser. And fueled by increasingly sophisticated Chinese infrastructure, physical and digital, Alibaba is growing.
Last year grew 62%, the year before that 74%, the year before that 80%. I mean, it's easy to imagine the company quadrupling in size over the next 4 years.
Now, all that said, Alibaba is not publicly traded yet, so there's very little information for investors to go on. But even so, analysts say the company is easily worth $150 billion. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Before the Affordable Care Act actually kicked in, the thinking was that every day one state would eventually run its own health insurance exchange. Only, in fact, about a quarter of them actually are or are trying to, and some are having a whole lot more success than others. Oregon is one of the others. After $300 million in federal startup money and months of technical glitches, the people who run Oregon's exchange voted today to have Washington, D.C. take over the IT side of things. From the Health Desk at the WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
There are lots of reasons why states may want to take over their exchanges from the feds sometime in the future, but here are six reasons why they may not be in such a hurry.
Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Oregon, and Vermont.
Caroline Pearson tracks state exchanges for consulting firm Avalere Health. She says technical disasters like Oregon, it's still processing applications on paper, could scare off most anyone else for the next year or two. But Pearson says as states and the federal government work out the bugs, running an exchange will get smoother.
Once you have something that's working, it will be easier for other states to import that and customize it and tweak it for their own program.
Sonia Schwartz with the Georgetown Center for Children and Families thinks states that run their own exchanges may be better able to control healthcare costs, and that could make switching worthwhile.
Our health system is expensive, and if we had an ambitious plan to rein in costs, you know, it's worth it. But if we were just going to kind of create a rinky-dink enrollment system, it's not worth it.
Moving forward, some states could take a hybrid approach, much like Oregon's doing now. Let the feds run the IT side of the business, but manage the types of insurance plans on the exchanges and oversee outreach and enrollment efforts. New rules and systems, though, could make things more complicated for insurers, says PricewaterhouseCoopers CeCe Connolly.
It's just like, how many different languages do you learn and can you master?
Connolly says the silver lining in struggling state-run exchanges may be that it forces everyone to standardize, a great way to keep costs down. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
You may have heard here and elsewhere that manufacturing in America is dead. I would refer you then to a report out today from the Boston Consulting Group in which you will learn that the United States is, and this is a quote, a rising star in global manufacturing. Number two, in fact, behind the Chinese. A lot of the jobs that that manufacturing growth is translating into are what are called middle skill jobs, which means you need more than high school, but less than necessarily a four-year college degree. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
I showered this morning, but the world I'm entering considers me filthy. That's why I barely recognize myself in the mirror. Every inch of my body is zipped up. Senior technician Joe Luke makes sure I'm properly attired.
You've got a face mask on, one-piece clean room suit with an attached hood. You have a separate glove.
Many people think of manufacturing as dirty work, but Global Foundries is the cleanest place you'll visit in your life.
Basically, we're making the chips that go in your car, computers, cell phones.
They work in a clean room because in the tiny universe of a semiconductor, a fallen eyelash is like a truckload of toxic waste. Once I'm all covered up, a door opens to a multi-billion dollar sci-fi landscape. It's vast, the size of six football fields, with these big, shiny robots whizzing overhead. Humans in white bunny suits walk the floor below, like technician Megan Bettner.
I think it's fun to see everybody else right there with you, looking equally weird and different with their getup on.
With everyone covered up, co-workers tell each other apart by their eyes. The suits are spooky, but the pay is excellent, even without a bachelor's degree. But finding people isn't easy.
It's a challenge.
Outside the clean room, technical training manager Don Garrison told me how he's hiring 400 techs this year. But there aren't enough people with the right skills in upstate New York. Recruiting elsewhere is expensive and doesn't always work out.
We need to hire people locally. People who live here and are from here, they want to stay here. We actually do have a problem when we relocate people from Arizona, from Texas. After about one or two winters, some of them may not want to do winter. We have some people that just say, hey, this isn't for me.
A shallow local talent pool is also a problem for New York leaders who spent a fortune on incentives to get Global Foundries to come here.
New York's intention was to provide employment to residents.
Michael Indolo with economic development firm Camoin Associates says taxpayers want to see more jobs go to New Yorkers.
The direct hiring at the site itself, it has been a little bit of a disappointment.
Turning that around requires a bigger and better educational pipeline. Paul Sisson is in it. He was grabbing a bite to eat at a supermarket coffee shop just down the road from Global Foundries.
Could I just get a small cafe vanilla, please? And could I also get one of the chocolate marble loaf cakes?
He used to work on the other side of that transaction, in bakeries and restaurant kitchens. 12-hour days, 6 days a week or more.
The most that I have ever made in an entire year was $28,000.
He sees an opportunity to make more, trading Cook's Whites for a bunny suit, citing numbers similar to what Global Foundries told me.
Most places start anywhere from like $45,000 a year up to, you know, $60,000 for a two-year degree.
Essentially what we're going to do is we are going to calibrate the quartz detector by adjusting the tooling factor.
That's what brings Sisson and others to this classroom for an associate's degree at Hudson Valley Community College. Nearly all will graduate with job offers. Associate Dean Penny Hill says about half already have bachelor's degrees.
We've always thought that a four-year degree is the answer to get a good-paying job, and now as we're experiencing, it's not always the right answer. The next room with the yellow glass on the windows is where we do most of the training for the semiconductor manufacturing technicians.
Its tech-focused campus is not what comes to mind when many people think of community college. It's in a new building with sparkling labs packed with high-tech equipment. Its semiconductor program is growing, but not fast enough for industry. This is the front line in the battle to get people ready for good middle-skilled jobs. And there's more at stake.
Productivity and performance of our manufacturing sector is driven by these middle-skilled jobs. And so they're just very important for the performance of the economy.
MIT management professor Paul Osterman worries the pipeline that'll connect future workers with these jobs isn't good enough.
It's a challenge that we're going to face, and that if we don't make investments in our training and education system, it's going to be very problematic.
Back in Hudson Valley's campus semiconductor lab, students get hands-on training working in a clean room. Paul Sisson is among students in bunny suits moving shiny round semiconductor wafers among various machines.
So we have a couple of different furnaces here that we use. This one right here is just it's our oxidation furnace. These are our silicon wafers right here.
The furnaces are high-tech ovens, three times hotter than the ones he used in his restaurant days. He gets a little kick out of the irony. Sisson's investment in a middle skills degree should net him a far greater paycheck than he got in the grueling chaos of the kitchen.
I can make more than double using my mind instead of breaking my body.
America's high-tech manufacturers will need far more people like him. Improving the pipeline and getting more people in it is something industry and educators need to figure out. In Malta, New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which emojis once again figure prominently, those little symbols you can make with certain keystrokes on your phone. We told you a couple of weeks ago about how Yelp now lets you search on them. Say a pair of scissors gets you a haircut place nearby. Now comes Skype, which has, according to the website TechCrunch, removed certain offensive emoticons from its online emoticon dictionary. We've got a link so you can see them for yourself, because actually, I can't say them on the radio. It is, of course, at marketplace.org. And with that, that's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Thanks today to the staff here at WAMU. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back in LA on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.